Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, and welcome to another episode of Voices for Excellence. I am your host, Dr. Michael Connor, CEO and founder of the Agile Evolutionary Group, and of course, the proud host of VFE. And today's guest, I like to say she's one of the legacy executive leaders, education leaders across the country. She is in the Bay Area. And yes, she has, I would like to say, have done everything in the education vertical over 30 years and now has her own company corporation that we're going to be talking about. But yes, LK Monroe, I'm a big fan, but you can actually see the excitement in my voice. LK Monroe is the proud former Office of Education County, Alameda County Superintendent of Schools. Now, I had a look at
that. It's okay. It's a mouthful
because LK was telling me that this title has been in existence since 1874. So obviously there's some legacy behind her being the superintendent.
No, I haven't been in the office that long, but it has existed. Let's just be clear.
This is why I love LK, because LK and I, we just vibe off like that. Yes, she is the superintendent of schools. Let me get this correct. The county superintendent of schools, right?
That's right. Alameda County Superintendent of Schools. That's what I was for 8 years.
That is a mouthful, 8 years. But again, like I said, the history, because I love how you said it. That title since 1874, you know that carries substance with that. But LK Monroe has just been, like I said, a staunch educator who has impacted many, many, many lives in the Bay Area, just underscoring, you know, within Alameda County, 225,000 students times 8 years. We already know the impact that LK has had. So without further ado, I want to welcome my good sister, my good friend, LK Monroe to Voices for Excellence. LK, the mouthful of the title, welcome.
Well, thank you so much. It is such a pleasure to be here. You know, those of us who are in this field, nothing makes us happier than to be able to talk about education and the impact education has. I'm a third generation educator. My grandmother was a teacher. My mother was a teacher. I started out as a teacher after I said I never would. And then I said, oh, all right, I'll do this teaching thing, but I'll never be an administrator. Okay, I'll be an administrator, but I won't be a superintendent. So what I learned after many, many years is never say never, but it was my honor to be the elected Alameda County Superintendent of Schools. It's a constitutional office. And now I'm in what I call my rewirement. So, and have started a social purpose corporation, which I know we'll talk more about.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you for everything. And to my audience, I remember I called LK one day, and when I was talking to LK, I met LK's mother. You remember that, LK?
I do.
She is a wonderful, wonderful lady. Again, when we talk about legacy, her legacy back in the Bay Area, what she did for education as well, just knowing her history. So hello to you, Ms. Monroe, as well. But LK, let's get started with this, because this is a fun question. And I love asking this to all of my participants, or guests, I should say, on VFE. But for educators that don't know who you are, right? Stakeholders in the ecosystem, leaders, teachers, practitioners, even from the business education vertical that now you have successfully disrupted in such a positive context. Now, what song describes your leadership signature in the AC stage of education after COVID-19?
I love that. I love the after COVID-19, because actually the song relates to COVID-19, but then I continue to adopt it and build on it. So it's I Am a Superwoman by Alicia Keys, because that line, so I was speaking at a conference then, and during COVID-19, I was the president of the organization of the 58 California superintendents. So I'm on the phone with the governor's office, you know, every 2 or 3 days. We're going to open schools. We're going to mask. We're not going to mask, all of that. And when I opened this conference, somebody asked me, hey, is there a song you'd like to come out to? I was like, how about I Am a Superwoman? Because it says, even when I'm a mess, I still put on a vest with an S on my chest. And I was like, how many of you have been a mess? And how many of you have shown up every day through all of this, persevered, and been the Superman, woman, super person for your context? And I feel like that's what these jobs are, whether it's COVID-19 or not. These are jobs that a lot of people would not raise their hand for. And, you know, all my colleagues who are listening, all my colleagues I've had the privilege of working with have, you know, they say that's the definition of a hero. Somebody runs towards trouble, and we like to solve problems. So we step all the way in and do that every day, even when we don't know the answer. So that's my song.
I love that, LK, right? Because that is so true. I am a superwoman, and you know, we come in, and I don't think many people truly understand and know some of the burdens that we carry into the job because we're trying to do the job so effectively. And we take it personal, right? Because it's kids. And when we're dealing with kids and you know, we have to come in and we continue to put the S on our chest no matter what. Yes, COVID. But when we think about now, right, that our leaders are what they're engaging in, developing and coordinating a recovery strategy to close specific content area gaps that they're facing, disengagement, right? How do we now get kids to be authentically engaged? Chronic absenteeism.
I was going to say, we have to get them there first, you know?
I mean, these things that our leaders are dealing with, and we still have to come in with the S on our chest because it's our nature as practitioners to problem seek, to problem solve, and we continuously to do that. But really love the song with that. I am a superwoman, Alicia Keys, big fan. We need to get another album out from Alicia, man. I tell you.
I'm telling you. I'm planning to go see that heading to New York soon for my East Coast people. And there's Hell's Kitchen is the Broadway show where she did the music. I'm looking forward to seeing that. So.
All right. You're going to be in New York City, the bay to the city.
Like coast to coast.
There you go, coast to coast. You got to let me know, but come and see you. But LK, I want to talk about your new organization that you started up because I like to say this. We have a lot of mutual business partners and cadres in the field, specifically when we talk about the Justice League. You have made a nice, seamless transition into the business education sector. And I truly appreciate, you know, having somebody with your knowledge and vitality for kids to be in this sector, continuously disrupt the business education vertical to improve their practices and how we look at kids. And your organization is called Teamed Up for Good, which directly brings athletes, artists, and philanthropic leaders across the ecosystem to address the core opportunity and access gaps that are insidiously impacting education. So one, I want you to unpack the mission of your organization, Teamed Up for Good, and who you have worked with from various industries. And you know, you're going to, and you cannot hold back because after you finish your answer, I'm going to tell everybody who you worked with, right? Big fan. I'm like, you were just nonchalantly just saying who you're working with. I'm like, how did you not fan them when they're right in front of you? But the second part is, right, the current impact of your work. Right? How is the organization right now impacting districts and leaders throughout the United States?
That's a big question. It's this has been a labor of love. Something I would say is that those of us who are in this phase of our career, often as we look at the next phase, we choose what we take on based on, I say, this is an oversimplification, but on a pet peeve or a pet project, like something we've always wanted to do or something that's made us mad that we haven't been able to do anything about in our career. And for me, what I say with Teamed Up for Good is that we do both strategic advising and professional learning. The strategic advising is the part where we talk to folks who are either, you know, in the field of professional athletes or we'll talk to people who are in philanthropy because everybody, you know, and you'll resonate with this, Michael, is that everybody, like you go to a cocktail party and some people, you know, think they know a little bit about what you do and they talk to you about it, but everybody's been to school. And so everybody has an opinion about what they think should happen in school. And so many people, like professional athletes, like philanthropy, want to do their best by children in education. And sometimes in doing that, either, you know, at the least, it doesn't work very well, doesn't have impact. At the most, it can sometimes do harm by going into a context where you didn't intend to do harm, but you have limited experiences. So I've seen that happen a lot over my career and said, on the other side, I am really going to help people who are looking to interface with public education systems, public education schools, and really help them do that education speak, that kind of translation that needs to happen. And sometimes, I mean, there's therapy involved because there's some frustration when you, I get a lot of the question, well, why is this and how come? And, you know, those kinds of questions, and some of it doesn't make sense. But if you've been in it for decades, you can predict it as sure as anything that, okay, what you're going to have to do is go in this way and make sure that you have thought about these particular factors before telling folks what you want them to do. So just to talk about who I've worked with, when the way this started is that a friend of a friend, and I used to, way back in the day, I'm a late career teacher. I didn't get my teaching credential till I was 40. This is how long I resisted being in the family business. And before that, I started at a nonprofit called EDTI, Educational Technology Training Institute for Teachers, as, you know, as a grant writer and consultant. And then I just kind of, you know, you're around education. My mother was like, have you thought about, it's like, oh, so I relented. And it was during a time when so many teachers were needed. Class size reduction was happening. And so took the job and got my credential as I was doing it. Anyway, all of that to say, I worked with athletes before this in a number of capacities. But then when I started Teamed Up for Good, there were athletes who were asking for this kind of support. So while I was superintendent, I would just advise, because I oversaw 18 school districts. So the county superintendent has fiscal and academic oversight of the districts in their county. And Alameda County has 18, you know, with Oakland and Fremont and the Silicon Valley being the biggest of the districts, Berkeley being another, Berkeley Unified. There was one particular athlete who wanted to set up some tech hubs while I was a superintendent. So the tech hubs were bring in the kids for, you know, kind of work-based learning and give them also job opportunities in the way of internships. And so what this mutual friend said, he was like, okay, look, we're going to launch this. We're going to invite mayors from several cities. We're going to invite supervisors. We're going to invite all these people. Would you just take a look at our presentation? This is how it started. And I was like, sure, I'll take a look. And it was going to be like it was 2 days before the presentation. I looked at it, I was like, oh my gosh. I was like, so none of this is true. Like, you can't actually do this. You know, this is not how education works. You can't just have kids come in and, you know, there are laws and rules that you're going to have to think about before you just grab a bunch of kids and put them in front of a computer. And are you partnering with a district or a community-based organization? What's, you know, so I said to Andre Iguodala, I said, I tell you what, I was like, you know, these people are coming because of you. That's why they're coming. They want to, you know, you're famous and they want to hear what your heart is for this. I was like, that's what you're going to tell them. You're going to tell them about why you're passionate about this and what you hope to do. The brass tacks part can come later. I was like, because we've got work to do. We have to figure out the brass tacks part. But, and he did, there was a pivot. I was like, take out 3/4 of the slides and just really talk about where this passion comes from and what you hope will manifest through this. And it really resonated with people. You know, the mayor of Oakland was there, the mayor Hayward was there, the supervisors from several cities around, people from higher education and public education. And it really just inspired people. And so then I worked with him for a little while after, and then another warrior sponsored one of the first programs we did as Teamed Up for Good. So, but it isn't just athletes. It's anyone who has a heart for education who isn't necessarily part of this industry, part of this landscape, and needs to know more, needs a partner to both push forward and also take the coattails and say, you know, we need to think about how we're entering in.
Yeah. And LK, what I'm very, very appreciative of, and I won't name drop or anything, for one, the second partner that she was working with, I'll give you a clue. And this is an objective fact. He is the greatest shooter of all time. And everybody knows who that is. But LK, what I appreciate about that, see, I'm a Connecticut guy. I would say Ray Allen, but we'll give the data there. You're streamlining the ideas and the vision of whether it be athletes or anybody that have had any traditional relationships with education, and you're bringing that knowledge in to be able to now take this very bold vision that he or she might have and really underscore these elements of the education thread that's needed for the impact, right? Because when I hear that story, I'm like, wow, you took this great idea and then now you provided the necessary support and ensure that is being leveraged with this level of vitality and to have profound impact within the education ecosystem, specifically in the Bay Area. You're doing some really good work now, you know, LK. I'm really, really appreciative of that. I even hear third party about the immense successes that you're having. I'm like, go, LK, go, right? But you keep doing you.
You know, LK. Just trying to keep up with you. I mean, literally.
That's a fallacy, whatever you heard. But
it's like a full-time job on its own, right?
I want you to put your county superintendent hat back on, because A, I want you, LK. It took me a while to really understand the educational structure of Alameda County. And this is an elected position. So when we talk about this to my audience, yes, LK had to go out. LK had a campaign. LK had to make a myriad of different speeches. And we know how big the Bay Area is. And then we had to have people finally vote for her and vote for the vision that she was articulating, communicating, and storytelling. But now that is a different pathology, a different route than the traditional superintendent, right? That they may embark upon. So what I want you to do now, LK, right? And just for my audience, you won by 53%. That's good. That's over the majority. So that's great. But what advice would you give current superintendents about navigating today's political landscape, specifically in education, right? And when I think of your position as county superintendent, you had to have this triangulation of balancing multiple superintendents, board of educations, that whole aspect of teaching and learning, the financial operations of all those districts, but also navigating the political landscape in the Bay Area. Now, wow, that triangulation is big, but what advice would you give today's superintendents? Because one day they have federal funding, the next day they don't, then they only have 25% of it. Then they're seeing that some of their programs are being eliminated. So we have to keep students at the forefront, right? And ensure their needs are met at a high level. So if I'm a superintendent now, how would I navigate that landscape?
That's an excellent question. It really is, because that's what a lot of my job was. That's particularly in the end, as the landscape has shifted, let's just say that a lot of the conversations were based on that. As county superintendents, so just quick kind of a primer on what county superintendency is. In the state of California, as you heard Dr. Connor say, from 1874, these have been oversight roles. And they've been elected roles, or constitutional roles. Of the 58 counties within California, which is now the fourth largest economy in the world, California just elevated from the fifth, these roles, 55 of the 58 are elected. I'm sorry, 50, there are five who are not elected. So 53 of the 58 are elected. The others are appointed either by Los Angeles is appointed by the Board of Supervisors, and others are appointed by the boards. So it's complex, but in the last 8 years, it has now become the oversight role. So the state doesn't take over when a district is failing. The county has to go in now. The county superintendent has to go in and support that district. So I sometimes have employees in districts helping, you know, right to any particular ship. And also with board members, we convene board members in the county and do professional development and, you know, different types of programs. So all of that to say, when I was convening superintendents, it was monthly on the regular, weekly during COVID, these things were coming up. Like, how actually do we prioritize? And in the Bay Area, many of you know, very strong labor presence, a lot of labor organizations. So superintendents having the pressure of giving unprecedented raises, which were needed because the Bay Area is incredibly expensive, and not using these temporary funds for ongoing costs. So some of the things that we would do would be convene, we would have workshops for the chief business officers and say, okay, these are the things you can use this money on. What does it mean if you go beyond that? All of that to say, some of what is going on now is, and I'm sure when you talk to superintendents, you have these conversations. One of the strengths that superintendents need to have is to, as you said, lead with kids, but understand that may be, what that may mean is that you may not have a job. You may not have a job at the end of the day. And for me, being elected, I won by over 50% my first time out against five other people. Second time ran unopposed. Did not win the third time. I did not really want to run the third time, but I didn't have a succession plan. It had fallen apart. And part of that was because the political landscape. As county superintendent, you have to say, no, I'm sorry, you can't afford that raise. You can't afford to, you know, the numbers just don't add up. And sometimes the powers that don't like that message will organize against that message. And at the end of the day, you have to be able to look at yourself and say, did I put kids first? Because if you spend all this money on this, how are you going to spend money on instruction? How are you going to not lay off people who are leading for essential services in the district? So it is hard. I'm not going to give you, I wish I could give superintendents sitting there now a very, you know, a kind of if then. If this happens, if you're seeing this, then this is what you want to do. The landscape is different now. And I think the best thing you can do is remember why you're there and remember that every constituent will always say and does believe in their heart, they're doing it for the kids. They're doing it for kids so that you have to understand, like, okay, how does that thing that seems so unreasonable to you actually manifest in, you know, being for the good of kids in their own mind? And the last thing I'll say about that is that you need to have your network around you. You need to have your support network because a lot of this is new territory for public education. So you need to have people who can help you navigate those tough questions and situations.
I say this all the time. The mass, the fluctuation, the elimination, the inertia that I'm seeing, it doesn't hurt. Well, it does hurt the adults because we've seen it. But moreover, it hurts our kids. And that's where, I mean, yeah, I always want to invite intellectual banter because I think that's how we grow as an Eagle Spare. Albeit, I believe that now we're seeing kids being hurt, and that's what upsets me, right? Because I always used to say this statement, okay, and it used to irk a lot of people. And I always used to say, I like the kids more than the adults. So my decisions are going to be on kids, and the adults probably will not like me because 99.9% of the chance my decision is going to be rooted on kids. And usually when you root your answers or root your practices on kids, you're disrupting, I like to say, the hidden culture, which is around being adult-centric, right? And you're right. I think that when we look at it from a theory of action statement standpoint, if, i.e., if, then, and, right, that follows that process, we don't have that anymore. There really isn't a true playbook anymore because, again, like I said, we don't know if we're going to have money. We don't know if we're not. I mean, I have superintendents right now trying to figure out what their next year budget is, but they don't know what the federal allocation is because they lost a significant amount of money one day that they didn't even know about. And then all of a sudden they have a portion of that money back and then some of that money is frozen. So all of that, all those processes or all of that kind of like that inertia, organizational inertia, federal level kind of like inertia chasms that we're seeing is hurting kids because we do need dollars to support our teachers. We do need dollars and resources to support our learning organizations. So thank you for that, LK, because you're right. The navigating today, it's a very difficult job. It is a very difficult job, even at the classroom level. We're seeing some of our teachers who are getting under fire from a political stance and political landscape. But let's move on to the next question because we could spend the next hour and a half on this. So one of my theory of actions when we talk about our value proposition is moving our education model to this, what I'm calling the 22nd century education model, right? Where it's inclusive, adaptive learning ecosystem, moving beyond some of the traditional norms of what we know of education. I like to say the Jeffersonian model, quoting Richard Carreau, but from a lens of being culturally responsive. And I don't understand why this have contention to it, because if you look at the public education demographics today, i.e. our students, 57% of them are Black and brown in public education, right? 21%. And here's the thing, y'all, and this is a stark metric I'm seeing. Generation Beta, who's going to be the most diverse group, over 20% of the students are going to be two or more races, where just 15 years before it was in single digits at 8%. So when we talk about being culturally responsive, we have to, if we want to adequately serve the majority of our demographics. But how do we reimagine a model with these contexts or factors in mind? And we're still pushing against some of the political landscape. Moreover, how do we move some of these traditional systems to meet, and we're going to put it back on kids, Generation Alpha and Generation Beta's needs in the AC stage of education?
So a lot of us are talking about this a lot of the time. The first thing we have to do is keep moving. We have to keep moving forward. There's a lot of debate, and I think it's a good conversation to have, but it can't stop there. There's a lot of debate about what is it we alter to be able to do it. So our language, the vernacular we use, so that it doesn't come under fire, or unapologetically just saying, this is what this is, you know, deal with it or don't, but this is what this is. There's room for both things, because as long as students are at the center of both things, then, you know, it's ultimately going to be a win-win. So for example, I was working with a group who their program also is qualified under California Ethnic Studies curriculum guidelines. And, you know, they lead with that, ethnic studies compliant. And I said, here's what I'm going to say. You know, I think that's fantastic. And there are a lot of districts who don't actually have a high quality ethnic studies offering. It may be now the second thing you say, not the first thing you say. You say, this is a amazing, you know, literacy opportunity that is ethnic studies compliant. I mean, it is down to that kind of thing with national hotlines for using particular words and all of that. What should not change is the programming, in my opinion. So for example, a lot of districts and places have spent, including, you know, Alameda County, which is one of the most diverse counties in the nation, has spent a lot of time on figuring out how to ensure that all groups of students, and mostly our students of color, because that's who's represented in our public schools, are, you know, seen, heard, served, all of those things that we prioritize. And what that means is that there are programs that have disrespectfully been lumped under a DEI moniker that actually are the lifeblood for a lot of our students and a lot of our communities. When we talk about culturally responsive practice, it's not something that is optional. It is who is in front of us. And unless we're thinking about how to best address the needs of those students, you know, unapologetically, then, you know, this game that's being played does not have an endpoint that's a win. So we may as well continue to put our heads down, serve our students of our the diverse needs of our students, and fight the skirmishes as they arise, because they will, and they do. And, you know, the noise will be there. But that, I think, for district leaders, for anyone, school leaders, for teacher leaders, that's your job, to make sure that you are that advocate and that voice who can continue to push forward. Nobody's going to be in professional learning communities that we host. Those are incredibly important spaces for practitioners who know that this is vital information. The professional development you offer your teachers, the headline moniker may change, but if anything, the content needs to be more pointed about how to meet the needs of diverse students.
Okay, when, you know, I hear this phrase that, you know, we can't say we want to have, or we want to ensure that students have a welcoming environment, right? Because it falls under that inclusive realm and is, you know, in the broader aspect of the DEI. I'm like, why are we making the simple hard? Like, okay, you and I, we go somewhere, we want to feel welcomed. Mm-hmm. I mean that there's no political or racial context. I just want to feel welcome. So if we need to make our students, we want them to feel, make them feel welcomed in their learning environments. We have a very diverse community. Our demographics are becoming even more diverse. So we have to find new ways to make our students feel welcome. I don't see any contention with that, but you're right. You know, we have to keep students at the core. You know, I look at, and LK, you know me so well, I look at things so factual based and analytically based. I don't understand some things that I'm like, where does the politics come in that, right? When we talk about metabolizing culturally responsive systems, I'm like, we need to, because 57% of our students are Black and Brown.
It's always there. The politics is always there.
But, you know, and here's the thing, when I was like, all right, this is a far stretch. When I heard that Jackie Robinson was a part of the DEI and had the stuff was being removed, I'm like, Jackie Robinson? Really? We really go after him? But that's another episode in itself. But
that's the level of desperation we've devolved to.
Jackie Robinson? Really? Come on. I mean, again, that's just me, but I don't see, that's history. I mean, what he did, I mean, that's just history. That's a part of American history.
It's a fact, right? What? Yeah.
But what he did and what he went through, I mean, there's nothing to that. But anyway, with your extensive knowledge in education, LK, I want you to define innovation and AI integration within the instructional model of education, right? And I want to break it down. You know, when we talk about core instruction, when we talk about levels of innovating pedagogy so that now the locus control of learning is on our students, right? When we think about now having that balance between AI and our students and really using it as a strategic tool to either close gaps or to accelerate learning, right? I'm afraid now we're missing this element of aligning technology and software with the learning needs of our students. I think that we have this oversaturation of tools, which is great for our teachers, but how do we now, as leaders, strategically align those tools to ensure we're getting the maximum academic return on investment for our students? So how do we achieve that alignment with the learning needs of our students, underscoring your definition of innovation and AI within our instructional model?
you used the word balance. I don't think we ever really strike a balance. First of all, every context is different. So this concept of innovation, let me back up to that a little bit, is what has gotten me involved now with a lot of ed tech folks. And that's some of the strategic advising I do is, what does that look like in schools? How does the way you enter into schools or the way you think about how kids are educated, how should it impact the way you enter into schools? So this idea of innovation, what always just, you know, blows my mind, I guess, is that our kids are already there. You know, our kids are already doing this. They are already legions ahead. They've used ChatGPT and all manner of things to accomplish goals that we can't even fathom. And so we're trying to catch up. And in the process of that, we're putting a lid on a lot of things. You know, a lot of districts just shut it down when it first happened. And I can't blame them because we're responsible for so much, you know, like we're responsible for protecting children. So when there's something that we don't understand and in our perception is potentially dangerous, shutting it down, understandable first reaction. But most districts right after that realized this is not shut downable. Like this thing is, first of all, it's already everywhere. We're just waking up to the fact that it is a tool that now we're learning how to harness and to utilize. But we're behind. And that's okay. That's just how it goes with generations and how generations evolve. What is not okay is if we don't try to understand and don't try to listen to the voices of young people who are saying, I'm using it in this way. Why wouldn't I do that? Why wouldn't I do that? So there's also another aspect. We need to listen to those voices of young people, but we also can't discount as seasoned professionals how the things that we know map on to this innovation. So not all of this, not in some cases, not even the majority of what is available is sufficient to be able to move things forward. So for example, if you hadn't spent the decades you spent in schools and leading, you would not be able to make a platform that relies heavily on technology, but it relies primarily on having seen a problem in a particular way that needs to be solved. So we have to live in that tension with our young people. We have to teach them to think critically, because you can't even ask the right questions if you can't think critically. And we know that all ChatGPT is based on, you know, the higher the quality is of your query, the better the answer is. And then being able to discern, like, is that answer right? I remember when ChatGPT first came out and I had to do a talk and I said, you know, make it, give me a short paragraph, give me a paragraph about this talk. And I input that data in L.K. Monroe's style. And it did. And I wasn't mad at it. It was fine. Like it gave me some ideas. And then I typed in, who is L.K. Monroe? Oh, we don't know. Don't have any idea who L.K. Monroe. I'm like, but you gave me that answer. And without even saying, we have no idea who you're asking us to emulate. So our young people are going to need to know that. And there is an over-reliance on their part with the tools. There's a fascination with it. There's an interest in it, which there should be, but it is our job as educators, adults, guides to say, so that's good. And yes, you can show me some things about how you're using it. My son does that all the time, you know, how you're using it. I'm like, wow, I had no idea. But then there's a follow-up like, well, how does that impact this? So it's taking it as a total package. That's why there'll never be a balance or heart. You have to have guidelines. You have to have rules about the use of AI and all those things, but you understand all of that is fluid. And next year, something else may be introduced that changes that. So the best thing you can do is stay forward thinking and understand that you have to be flexible even as you protect those you are charged with.
Absolutely. Flexibility. Okay. And I love your statement where you said, live in the tension, right? Because you are absolutely 100% correct. When I think about the instructional design, software design, product development process, the Agile Diagnostic and AI Platform, and the Systems AI Navigator, the back-end design is all focused on what lived experiences. Me as a superintendent, chief academic officer, assistant superintendent of teaching and learning, assistant principal, curriculum specialist, and classroom practitioner. It's all the lived experiences in this strategic conglomerate that is infused into the software, where the output is around continuous improvement, change management using AI. But you are absolutely right. In order to get the software to where it needs, you have to bring in that lived tension from this whole aspect of it. And you talked about this polarity, right? Polarity of some of our foundational practices from living in that tension to now this world that we're living in around digitalization of new technologies that can and will enhance the model that we continuously to underscore. I love how you said it. We have to go back to the crowd, the wisdoms from the crowd, our student voices, because you're absolutely right. Okay. Technology and AI, it is now it's a ubiquitous thread in our life. And the research states that, you know, one out of every 3 seconds, we're engaging in some type of form of technology in our life. Mainly the reason why that data is so small between 1 and 3 seconds is because of the iPhone. We always are on it, checking on it. We're doing something, right?
Or your Android, for those of you who are Droid people.
Android, yes. So LK, and one of my keynotes, I was talking about LK. Yes, transition is hard. You know, transformation is hard. Change is hard. And somebody asked me, do we really have to move to this 22nd century education model? And I said, you know, because the transformation is going to be really hard. And I was like, well, let's go back to our personal lives, right? I was like, how many people owned a BlackBerry? Everybody raised their hand. We started laughing because of BlackBerry. And I was like, well, how many people had difficulty transitioning from the BlackBerry to the iPhone and who denied it at first? Everybody raised their hand. And I was like, and now if we think about it, 12 to 15 years later, we can't live without this. That initial, right, chasm tension of how we're transitioning from one to the other is going to take time, where we're going to have to be able to leverage that. So I love that live with the tension, but use our students and their voice and exercise that flexibility and guidelines. So foundational. And when we talk about the algorithms, right, they can pull your work up, LK, but they don't know who you are. We just know LK Monroe. That's it. That's like me citing like research saying, yeah, and LK Monroe states blah, 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 blah. Do you know who she is? Nah, I don't.
Never heard of her. Yeah. So they have to be smart enough to check your sources.
Check your sources, right? LK Monroe. But LK, this is the last question. Good sister, you made it through VMEA. But this last question, and I'm going to try to limit you to 3 words. Now, nobody follows the rules, okay? So let's take it as it is, as I always tell each of my guests. What 3 words do you want today's audience to leave our podcast with regarding women in leadership in the AC stage of education?
Woo! That's a big one. If I'd limit this to women, but I can certainly put a woman spin on it, a woman leadership spin on it, a lens.
The reason I ask this question, LK, is when we look at the data, I believe that the latest that I saw, there's only like roughly about 2%, right? 1.8, raise it up to 2% of our superintendents and CEOs across the country are Black and brown women, let alone only 3% are women in totality.
those are staggering statistics, and I definitely lived them. I was the second African-American county superintendent ever elected. I was the first woman ever elected, an office that has existed since 1874, and I was the first Black woman ever to hold the office. So I understand. I'm going to give you my three words. I'm going to tell you why I have them very quickly. But they're justice, partnership, and excellence. So when I took over leadership at the Alameda County Office of Education, I had to really spend a lot of time, one, helping people understand what we stood for, and two, living up to what I said that we stood for. So our principles were stand up for justice, stand together in partnership, stand out in excellence. So we stood up, we stood together, and we stood out, which was really important for our county, for people to see us leading in education in that way. Here's what I'm going to say about how that maps onto women in leadership. I think women, men in leadership too, particularly men of color, really have a justice orientation, but justice is really at the core of public education. And for people like we have just talked about, has been given a bad name, you know, social justice, and that's what you're all about. But justice at its core is why we do this. We believe that all children should have access to a free, fair, public education, a high quality education. That's justice. And within that setting, there need to be just circumstances for them to flourish in. Standing together in partnership is really important, particularly now that things are so divisive. And I actually feel that as women in leadership, and you know, I have actually a superwoman talk that I give talking about what that means to stand together in partnership. It's something that many women in leadership are more successful at than men in leadership. Really, you know, you said earlier, have your people that you call, have that cadre of people that you rely on, and that standing together a partnership is lifting each other up in ways that the job often tears down. So that's really important. And then standing out in excellence, we as women in leadership, people of color in leadership, but especially women in leadership, standing out in excellence is important. It's critical. We tend to overachieve because we understand that we have to show up that much better from the start. So standing out in excellence is important because I believe that there is a greater level of scrutiny on our leadership, and we need to help one another be excellent. The fact that you, if I'm talking to women leadership, in leadership, occupy this position right there shows that there's a commitment to excellence, because just for you to have ascended to it.
I love that answer. Okay. Justice, partnership, and excellence. LK Monroe, thank you. It was such an honor. My friend, my sister, thank you for coming on VFE. I just love talking to you, right?
It's mutual. It's my privilege to be here.
We have some of the best conversations to my audience. We have some of the best conversations, talk about the best stuff, but we got to connect. But LK, for my audience that want to continue or to expand on some of your answers, some of your insights, some of your lived experiences, that they can be able to reach out to you and continue to ask you questions or certain comments, how would they be able to get in touch with you?
Teamedupforgood.com. And so you can go to that website, and my email address is lkmonroe@teamedupforgood.com. So I'd be honored to continue the conversation with any of your listeners. You know us, we could talk about this all day long and longer. So it just fills my heart and my spirit. So thank you for having me on. I just think this is such a great service to the community.
Thank you, LK, for coming on. And listen, I will be out in the Bay. I had promised a friend of mine that I would go to the Golden State Warriors championship parade if they win it. And I'm like, wait, hold on. Y'all got to get through Houston. And then after Houston, Minnesota.
We have done it before. So pack your bag.
I'm a Knicks fan. I've been waiting since I was before I was even born, 73. So I'm waiting for that Knicks parade, right? But we got to get through the Pistons first.
And this is where patience is so important.
Okay. Thank you so much for coming on, good sister. Like I said, I'll give you a call soon so we can be able to get together.
Sounds good. All right. Take care.
All right. Take care. And on that note, everybody, onward and upward. Have a great evening.